Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Quick note before we dive in. This week, Andrew and I were thrilled to be joined by Jess Phoenix, renowned geologist, volcanologist, and co-founder CEO of Blueprint Earth, which is an awesome nonprofit environmental research organization. We did have some technical difficulties connecting with Jess, so you're going to hear a significant drop in audio quality towards the end of the episode. We hope this doesn't ruin anything for anyone. Jess is in a part of California that's currently being devastated by wildfires and all kinds of natural disasters, so we were honored she made time for us in spite of all that. But you will hear a significant drop in audio quality, as I mentioned. So without further ado, Jess Phoenix, we had an awesome chat. Hope you enjoy it. I just want to set you up a little more. You've got a bachelor's from Smith College in history and your master's from CSU, California State University, in geology. Is that right?
Yes, that is. And I actually also have, I'll be forever all but dissertation on my PhD in geology, which I was doing at the Queensland University of Technology in Australia when the project changed and it didn't work for me anymore. So I left that and ended up going into mining, of all things. And it actually sort of opened up my eyes to the possibilities of blending industry and academia. And then on top of that, I also have an MFA in nonfiction writing from Goucher College.
And your parents were both FBI agents, right?
Yeah, it was a really interesting childhood. I actually could speak fully in acronyms by the time I was like 8 or 9. And our dinner table conversations were, you know, one part terrifying, one part fascinating. And as a result, I have been like a very well-behaved child and adult. You know, the fear of, not just the fear of God, but the fear of mom and dad is a real thing when your parents are in the FBI.
Wow. That's insane. And I read on your Wikipedia that they were climate change deniers until you launched into this profession of yours and started educating them, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, it was, it's more my dad than my mom. She's a little bit more moderate, but yeah, it's been a real hard slog because my dad's watching a lot of Fox News and has been for a couple decades now. So communicating with them and pointing out to them how, you know what, you're going to blame it all on George Soros's big money and big green, blah, blah, blah. But how many scientists do you know who are rolling in dough? I mean, obviously, I'm not one of them, because if I was, I wouldn't still be paying student loans every month. And that argument seems to get my dad to consider a little bit more that maybe it's not how Fox News makes it seem.
Yeah, there's a lot more money on the other side.
Andrew, why don't you take it away? Because you had a couple good questions.
Yeah, so volcanoes. Bill Bryson, in his book, talks about Yellowstone, how it's maybe going to blow in the next like 500,000 years or something like that. Is that a realistic end of the world scenario, volcano?
Well, it's a little bit more complex. I mean, obviously, volcanologists know that super volcanic level eruptions occur. We actually have a scale for ranking the severity of a volcanic eruption. It's called the VEI, which is the Volcanic Explosivity Index. And essentially, it goes from 0, which is like a Hawaiian-style oozy sort of eruption, to an 8, which is a super volcano level 1. And Yellowstone has produced VEI 8 level eruptions before, and it's done it 3 times in the quote-unquote recent past, because obviously geologic time is a lot bigger than human time. So it has erupted about every 640,000 years for the last 3 times. So 640,000 years ago, 1.2 million years ago, and, you know, a little over that, and add another 640, and you get the date of the earliest eruption. So it does do that. However, it doesn't erupt to the scale where we all die. Like, this isn't a Chicxulub meteorite impact killing all the dinosaurs level event. This is a couple years of cooling, because volcanoes produce gases and acid gases and particulates that actually create an insulating blanket that prevents the sun's rays from warming the earth. So volcanoes, although they do produce CO2, they only produce about, well, less than 1% of all that humans produce annually. And even then, when they do erupt, it produces a cooling effect, not a warming one. So yes, if Yellowstone erupts, in our lifetimes, it would be very bad. But the odds of that happening are, I mean, you're better off playing the lottery. You'd probably win the lottery twice over before you get a major Yellowstone eruption. If it does erupt, it's more likely to be a little steam-driven eruption that would be just really localized and wouldn't be anything that would harm anybody unless they were standing right near the vent.
Let's say we have one happen that was equivalent to one that happened within the last million years, the biggest one in the last million years. Are we talking the United States would be, you know, severely damaged at least eastwards of the Mississippi or the Rockies, eastwards of the Rockies? Are we talking about just Iowa? Are we talking about like global climate catastrophe? Or are we talking about like agricultural yields failing around the world? We're talking about like end of the dinosaurs? What are we talking about?
Well, okay, so Iowa is probably screwed, as are most things due east of Yellowstone itself. And it can reach pretty far to the east, that ash cloud. It's actually the ash that's the really big hazard. It won't be something that would kill all the crops, so to speak, around the world, but you would probably see effects around the United States. And then, of course, any countries that experience the cooling effects that you would get from the size of an eruption that we're talking about, a VEI level 8 eruption.
Well, this sounds like a good thing.
Lovely.
Bad joke.
The real hazard here is that ash. Volcanic ash is, of course, pulverized rock fragments. It's not fireplace ash. A lot of people think, oh, ash is ash. Like, it's the same thing that comes off the end of a cigarette. And it's not. That pulverized rock is very dangerous because it's heavy, and it can collapse roofs, and it also can shred the inside of your lungs. Plus, it's going to have a high silica content, and that silica is really bad when you breathe it in. So it's very hazardous to your health, and that's what we're really looking at. Not so much, you know, species-level extinctions, but definitely you're kind of screwed if you're east of the volcano itself.
You said anywhere east of Yellowstone would be devastated, but I'm wondering how far, I mean, we're talking in extreme hypotheticals here, but since we're on the subject, I mean, how far are you talking that would reach, and, you know, how far south would it reach too?
Well, to the south, I'm not super clear on. I don't really remember seeing the projected maps for the hazard area, but I know that parts of Colorado, and it could be as far south as New Mexico, but I would need to check that. But I can say for sure that it could, the ash is very likely to reach the eastern seaboard, and that's something that we can actually see in the rock record from previous eruptions. So it is a pretty big eruptive event.
So when you talk about global cooling, as Julian said, kind of almost as a joke, that sounds like a good thing. And to be clear, we're talking about like blocking sunlight, so it would have a huge negative impact on a lot of other things like plant growth and agriculture, as you mentioned. So it's definitely not a good thing. But I am curious about your stance on geoengineering, and I assume you think it's not the best way to proceed, but do you think it's even viable?
Well, geoengineering is kind of an interesting concept, and I think that it's something that, just like any big technological advance that we make, we need to enter into it and be really aware that everything we do has flow-through effects. So you can try to change, you know, one facet of the environment, and it might actually impact other parts of it that we weren't necessarily expecting or predicting. So there are instances where people can use parts of an ecosystem and try to support that ecosystem and enhance those parts to help reduce the effects of climate change. Like, for example, I was just reading recently about whales, and whales are apparently a really big carbon sink. They actually remove carbon from the cycle. So if we were to return whales to, you know, the number of whales to pre-whaling numbers, then we would actually be able to negate a lot of net carbon output. I forget, it was some huge amount. I don't remember if it was the amount the U.S. produces annually or something larger than that. But essentially, we can use whales to help solve the issues we're dealing with climate change. And so that's the kind of geoengineering that I can fully get behind. And, you know, when you're actually taking a natural system and you're restoring it to a more functional state.
But just so the listeners understand, what we're talking about with geoengineering is basically making like artificial volcanoes would be one method of geoengineering where you would intentionally put particles up in the atmosphere that would block sunlight and cool Earth to help reduce the effects, as you say, of human-driven climate change. The idea is we could do something active to try to counterbalance climate change, but as Jess says, there's like risks to it because we don't understand everything about it, and we may want to start small. So just want to clarify what that is. Yeah.
Well, I actually am a little bit unusual in volcanologist land, and that is because I was invited to participate in some climate change research on Little Ice Age era glacial remains. They're called moraines, and it's kind of what the glacier pushes in front of it as it advances, and then it's the debris that it leaves behind when it melts. So I worked on those in Peru, and we helped correlate the presence of those glaciers and their extent with when the Little Ice Age was happening in Europe. So I got to do that right after I graduated with my master's degree. And since then, you know, I've been really active with my nonprofit, Blueprint Earth. And it's one of the things that we're trying to do is create blueprints of Earth's environments. And we're starting with the desert biome. So we're actually out in California's Mojave Desert. And we're trying to see how everything is connected as a system. And that's so that we can actually use that knowledge to help with climate change's effects, to restore damaged environments, to help with humanitarian problems like deforestation, and then also someday for space. So if we want to be able to send people to the moon or to Mars for a longer term, we need to be able to optimize an environment to go up there. And that requires deep knowledge of how it functions as a system. And so I've been kind of more invested in doing climate change research and climate change adjacent work than your typical volcanologist would be. But it is super pressing. And I've done a lot of communicating about it with the public, whether it's, you know, via international news programs or when I was running for office. But it's something that we really need scientists speaking up and speaking out about if we want the public to really understand how serious it is. And actually, not all climate change is caused by humans. In fact, the Earth goes through cycles. That's something that we can see reflected in the rock record. And we've known that the Earth goes through these cyclic changes where the pendulum swings between a warmer environment to, say, a snowball Earth, where you've got massive glaciers over almost everything. And, because of that, we really try to focus on the human-caused climate change when it comes to educating people and speaking about it. And it's also of note, I think, to point out that even though we have these natural cycles that we can document, and even though we are technically still in an ice age, because we have the poles covered by ice caps, that's the definition. So we're technically in an ice age right now, but we're not at a glacial maximum. So even though we know that these things happen naturally, we really have to focus in on the things that we are doing to put our finger on the scale.
I wonder and this might be a dumb question, but you were saying that that humans aren't the only cause of climate change, and I'm wondering what natural causes there are that are just beyond our control.
We have big events like, say, a giant meteorite impact or massive volcanic eruptions on a scale that, you know, modern humans can't even conceive. It's the Deccan Traps in India. When those eruptions occurred, I mean, that just pumped so much out into the atmosphere that it had undeniable impacts on the global climate. And the Earth was originally basically, you know, roiling massive volcanoes with no landmass. So this is something that we can document the evolution of the planet and also the cyclical nature of the shifting climate. Really well. So, you know, it's not all humans, but it's also these big scale events that we as humans don't always have a good sense of unless we take a step back and really examine the stories that are captured in the rocks. That's how geologists, we do our detective work that way.
So speaking of which, I always thought it would be super easy to outrun lava, but I know that's incredibly naive because it just seems like, oh, like lava, how fast can lava travel? Like, it's just going to like flow down the mountain really slow. And you're like, aha, you can like outrun the lava. But, you know, if you have, but so I also think that, so lava is not the thing that kills people, right? Like with Pompeii, it's like the explosion and the ash and those kinds of things, right? So how dangerous, what are the relative dangers of a volcano? Let's say if you're living in Pompeii and the volcano Vesuvius just exploded and it's coming for you, like, can you leave? Can you just, oh, the volcano is like 10 miles away. Let's just run for it.
Yeah, that's actually a really common misconception. People think that lava is like super fast and it's the thing to be afraid of with a volcanic eruption, and it totally isn't. The thing, like the example you used of Pompeii, the thing that actually killed most people, especially initially during the early phases of the eruption, would have been pyroclastic flows. And pyroclastic flows, I mean, it sounds badass, just you know, with that name. But what it is, when you picture a volcano spewing straight up, like a Mount St. Helens style eruption or a Vesuvius style eruption, it's, you've got an eruption column that goes up from the volcano. And that column is made of volcanic ash, that pulverized rock that we talked about earlier. And of course, there's gases as well. And they're being forced up due to, you know, the pressure that has built up underground. And when the material that's in that eruption column is too heavy to be carried up by the gases and everything and the actual force, it will fall out of that column and it forms these pyroclastic flows. And what they are is clouds of ash and rock fragments that come, and gases, of course, that come shooting down the flanks of the volcano at speeds, you know, between 400 and 500 miles an hour. That's how fast they've been recorded. So that's what obliterated most of the folks in Pompeii. And you can't outrun that. Like, you are really, really screwed. And at Mount St. Helens, actually, pyroclastic flow is what killed Dave Johnston, the USGS geologist who was monitoring St. Helens the morning that it erupted. He only had time to actually say, "Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it," before the pyroclastic flow overtook him and wiped him out. So those are the real hazards. Lava, it's just not that fast. Your average lava flow, if you're walking briskly, you would be able to get away from it. And even the runniest of lava flows, which are like the Hawaiian basaltic lava flows, which have low silica content, and they're just a little oozier. Silica is very sticky, doesn't like to flow. So basalt has less silica, and it's fast in terms of lava. That stuff, like Mauna Loa, erupted, and it took a week for the lava from the summit to get down to the ocean. And, you know, that's, I forget exactly the mileage, but it's 30 miles or so, I want to say. And, you know, don't hold me to that, but it was not that fast, basically, is what I'm trying to convey. You definitely could have outwalked it.
I want to backtrack for a minute to something you said and ask a really, really stupid question. Just for devil's advocate, I just want to hear what you're going to say. You were saying we're technically in an ice age, and it makes me wonder, is it possible that people are blowing this whole the ice caps are melting thing out of proportion?
Okay, so I think that what we have to do with this question is really look at the data. And the data reflects that we're seeing unprecedented rates of melt, at least in terms of anything humans have been around to witness. It's something that we are going to be really hard-pressed to adjust to. I mean, the data is there. We're seeing Greenland is thawing at a pretty alarming rate. And in the Arctic and Antarctic, we see examples of, you know, city-sized parts of glaciers just breaking off. And all of that is feeding into the system at a rate that means we got to get our act together. Otherwise, we're going to be seeing some serious, serious ramifications. So I'd say there's pretty much no chance that the data are, you know, I don't think we're crying wolf here.
I'm not discounting that. I mean, I'm asking maybe like a slightly more obscure question than I'm letting on. I'm saying, like, obviously the ice caps melting is going to cause problems. Sea levels are going to rise. Towns are going to be disrupted. People are going to be displaced. But environmentally speaking, on the other side of all that, like, besides the people being displaced and all that stuff, like, is it an environmental problem for them to melt?
Ah, yes. Okay. So it is not a problem for the planet. I mean, the planet, like we talked about before, it goes through these cycles. And Typically, though, the organisms on the planet are able to adapt because the rate of change is a lot slower. Yeah, we go through these big shifts, but they're over a longer period of time. They're on a geologic time scale, which is, I mean, the planet operates on a billion-year scale. I mean, we're 4.54 billion years old as a planet, and humans have only been around in our present form for give or take 2 million years. So we can't necessarily, I mean, humans may be able to adapt, but for ecosystems that depend on certain key organisms, if those organisms are wiped out because they can't adapt fast enough, there's nothing we can do. We are at that point, we've painted ourselves into a corner. So I think, you know, yes, the planet as a whole obviously will be fine. The volcanoes will keep doing their thing and the tectonic plates will do what they do. But, you know, polar bears may not make it through. And then you may see ecosystem collapse due to the loss of keystone species.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of speed, right? So, like, geologically, Earth has had periods before when there was no ice, but we're talking the changes over millions of years or thousands of years or at least tens of thousands or tens of thousands of years. But in this case, we're talking tens of years, right? And so species don't have an opportunity to adapt. Environments don't change. So, I mean, it's going to have a huge effect that way. But more importantly, we are talking about people being displaced. Like, the really thing that we care about, like, it's nice to care about polar bears, but what we really ultimately care about, I think, at least I do, is what effect does that have on humans in some way that we're not expecting, right? Like it could collapse the Arctic fisheries or whatever effect it has on humans. Ultimately, I think that's one of the things that we most care about. We don't really know. Is that accurate?
Oh, definitely. We have to be able to communicate the impacts that people are really going to feel. I mean, the loss of the polar bears probably wouldn't impact you or I on a daily basis unless you're secretly based in Alaska and, you know, in an Inuit fishing village, which I doubt you are. But for the people who are part of those ecosystems, you know, they will be in serious trouble. But what we have to really do in order to personalize this for people is to make sure they understand what the real impacts will be. So whether that's seeing climate refugees, migrating because of the impacts of climate change, or whether it's because you have increased food insecurity or increased terror threats because the terrorists now have better leverage over populations due to the changing climate. If you can tell people, hey, you know, if X happens, then Y, that means Z for you, they're going to understand that a lot better. So in California, you can say, if you're not a fan of these wildfires, maybe you ought to look at your carbon footprint and see what you can do to help reduce your CO2 output. And that's what's critical in getting the public engaged in this effort to solve human-caused climate change.
It's a perfect segue into the next topic.
Exactly.
So we want to ask you about your political career, I guess, political bid, let's say, and just your involvement in politics and why you think it's important, what you think you can change, and what it was like, actually, just your experiences running for Congress.
Well, the short answer is it's mostly hell to run for office.
terrible.
Seems like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like torture, especially if you're a scientist and you exist in the world of facts and rationality and logic, and you sit here and you go, guys, evidence-based policymaking, and what comes back to you is, oh yes, but person X lied, so they're going to get our support, or person Y has more money, so it doesn't matter that they have no viable policy, but they have more money, so guess what? They're getting our support. That sort of thing. It was really an eye opener because I approach everything I do with a high degree of integrity, and one of the reasons I thought, well, I could run, is not just because I'm a scientist and I have that background of basically trying to eliminate uncertainty. That's what scientists fundamentally do. We ask questions and then try to answer them by getting rid of uncertainty. But I've been like a pretty upstanding person. And I think that's largely because my parents terrified the crap out of me as a child. So I never did anything wrong. Like I still never even tried any substance that is illicit, like, which is so funny because I live in California and people are like, well, you must smoke pot. I'm like, no, never. I've never even done that. So I was like, I'm squeaky clean, and realizing that doesn't actually matter because the powers that be, they frankly don't care. What they care about is how much money did you raise? Because the system has been twisted to the point where we have Citizens United in effect, which that was the Supreme Court decision that basically said, you know, corporations are people and they can donate politically, make gifts politically, which it essentially created this dynamic in D.C. of professional political consultants. You have this new class of people who their whole job is just to work on campaigns, as many campaigns as possible. And like, it'll be young people usually who come from, let's say you got a young person from Topeka who loves politics, and she goes and she works on a campaign in Iowa, and then she goes and works on a campaign in Florida, and then one in New York. And, you know, it goes on and on, but her livelihood is directly tied to candidates spending money to employ her. And, you know, she may be knocking doors, which makes sense, but she also may be doing social media posting. And you sit there and you think it's all about advertising. It's, you know, buying TV ads, sending out mailers. That is what wins elections. It's not sound policy, and it's not being a person of integrity. It really is how many people are you going to employ as part of the political machine? And, you know, what I learned is that the only way we're going to change this is if we have campaign finance reform. So to me, that actually is the most critical issue facing our democracy is, can we do this? And if we can't, we should just resign ourselves to being represented by professional fundraisers.
Yeah, man, that is
totally
so messed up.
Yes.
That's actually depressing. You've depressed me now.
Sorry. Well, I can give you something good here. I can't say, like I said, it's mostly hell. I didn't say it was all hell because I met really, really awesome people when I was running, and they were the people in my community and people from around the country who were supporting me. And like, I mean, these are people who, some of them had never been active politically, and like a lot of them were from the Star Trek community because, you know, I'm a sci-fi fan. I love Star Trek. And I gave an interview to Wired and for one of their podcasts, and it was like number one trending thing on Reddit for one day back December, like 2 years ago. And I tell you, it was bizarre walking around New York being like, I'm the number one trending thing on Reddit.
yeah.
It was New York, so literally no one cared, and it was great. But it, like, when that happened, the whole reason that I reached so many people was that I said, I want to bring Star Trek values to Congress. And it sounded super nerdy, but if you actually look at what Star Trek values are, like infinite diversity and infinite combinations, live long and prosper, a society that is post-money, post-war, post-famine, you know, where everyone has a job that suits them, where they can feel like they're helping to expand our knowledge of the universe. I'm like, that should be appealing to everyone, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
So, but
it's a pajama utopia.
Yep. I mean, that's the idea, right? And the only people who were in conflict in the Star Trek universe were basically people who weren't already part of the equitable society that, you know, was created there by the Federation. So it's interesting. And the kind of people who gravitated towards that, they weren't just sci-fi geeks. It was often young people who said, yeah, why can't we be shooting for that sort of world? Like, why do we have to settle for, you know, living in our parents' basements and being maligned for eating avocado toast? You know, I mean, like, no, this generation has more capability. You know, the generations that are coming into their political consciousness right now have more capability than any throughout history of any time. And it's like, we gotta turn them on to being part of the process. And I was super encouraged by the high school students who worked with my campaign, who would like volunteer for me, who put on a gun violence forum after the Parkland shooting. The students are leading. They already know. And so I'm not completely discouraged. I mean, I don't have kids, but I have a lot of friends who do, and I work with students all the time. And if it wasn't for them, I'd probably be like slowly banging my head on a wall 24/7, but I'm not.
That's why it's really important to have scientists in politics, because, you know, they bring new ideas and new information. And I mean, I'm like the epitome of like a rationalist person who thinks that you should always make all decisions weighing all evidence in a most rational way. Unfortunately, sometimes there's a lot of uncertainties and stuff like that, which is not at all, as you say, the way that politics actually works.
Which is ironic because you think that the policies are there to mitigate uncertainty.
You would think.
So I guess Citizens United is probably the most important thing we can do, as you say. In terms of, I do feel like people are, I don't know if I'm naive, but I do feel like people are coming around. I mean, change is always very slow in society, and there's always a third of people who don't agree with you on everything, right? So, getting to this Star Trek future, I think it's, I wonder whether, how much of it's possible, because it is utopia and it's kind of dreamy. And like young people, as you say, definitely are more socialist. And as you get older, you become more conservative. That's just like the thing that happens because you have responsibilities and you learn more information and you kind of, but I also share that vision, but I don't know that it's completely realistic. I think going in that direction is good. I'm just trying to understand what you think, like how we deal with some of these challenges and what the best way to approach it is.
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, which is also funny because most eternal optimists don't go into politics at all. But I think it comes, it's part of it's just my personality. I mean, growing up as somebody who was an athlete and engaged in a lot of academic stuff as well, it's sort of like, okay, we lost now, but here, get up and keep going. Try harder, work harder, do better, you know, like keep pushing yourself, change your strategy, condition yourself more, and you can do it. And that's what we do as scientists too. Like we have a hypothesis and we're okay with it failing because then we realize what the flaws were and we can move forward in a way that will maybe bring success to whatever we're trying to do. So I think it's so important to recognize that while we may say, okay, we want to, for example, end poverty. Wouldn't that be great? I mean, that would be amazing. But it's never going to be 100% possible. But we can sit there and go, we want to come as close to that goal as we possibly can. And it is something, because it's a system-wide change, not just a discrete single event, it's okay if we're not 100% accurate. Like if they had said, oh, close is fine for landing on the moon, you know, those guys would have died. But when it comes to, okay, look, we can make sure that every person has access to clean drinking water in, you know, the state of Maryland. Like that's something that's achievable. And that's something where we can get, everybody may have access to clean drinking water, but they may have to go down, you know, somewhere not their house to get it. And that's what you see in some countries right now. People are saying, okay, well, we can't get it all plumbed into your house, but we can get make it so that you all have access to it. So it's not perfect, but it is definitely better than some people having no clean sanitary water or, you know, having no resources if they are poor. And I mean, what I see too right now is really exciting. And this is something that I think the scientific community isn't talking about enough, is that the UN has released their sustainable development goals. There are 17 of them, which sounds like an insanely high number because people can only generally remember like three things at once in a list. So I can't remember all of them. But to me, some of them are really, really good and some of them are less useful because they're dependent on some of the other goals. But I love that several somebodies have put together a framework for where we would like to see our global society go. And without big, you know, moonshot type goals, we don't really have any sort of guiding North Star. So I think we need that sort of eternal optimism and pie in the sky way of looking at things. And then we temper it with reality and logic and with testing and with, you know, innovation and advancement and failure. Failure is part of how we advance. And if we don't embrace that, then we're never going to make any progress.
Yeah, I agree.
What do you think about Andrew Yang's idea of giving out $10 instead of having fund, the way, you know, currently works and companies can give unlimited money, but you have reform where instead of having companies basically fund our elections, you have every American citizen gets $10 to donate to whichever political candidate they like the best. And then it's really is from the people, right?
Yeah, I mean, that fits with my my idea for, you know, publicly funded elections. I think that's what we need. And however you get to that point where it's public funding and you don't have private corporations or special interests backing every single thing and swaying through lobbying, if we can eliminate that, we're doing well. And I don't care if you give everybody $10 or if you just say, guess what? Each candidate gets a set amount of money and that's what they can use. And then we're only going to campaign for 3 months, you know, not for 2 years. You know, I think whatever we do is going to be an improvement. And I, you know, being a scientist, actually one time when I was at one of the debates, when I was running for Congress, it's the one time that people gave me a little bit of grief for one of my answers. Usually people loved my answers, but On this example, they said, what would you consider in terms of tax reform? And so I was listing things. You know, I was saying, okay, you know, we could look at a graduated tax. We can look at a flat tax. We can look at this. We can look at that. But because I used the words flat tax, and I know flat taxes aren't equitable, I didn't want to enact a flat tax. What I was trying to say look at everything. I'm a scientist. I definitely want to look at everything. You don't want to rule something out before you've fully examined it. And that sort of attitude actually freaks people out in politics. So it's...
It's like flip-flopper when people change their mind. The quality that we should look for the most in politicians is that they're able to change their mind when presented with new evidence.
Yes. Oh, my God. Hear. I mean, that's just being a rational, mature person. I mean, your views, as you mentioned, a lot of times, and actually it's interesting to note, while men often become more conservative as they get older, women often become more liberal. And I think that's interesting as well. And, you know, I don't think they've done a lot of research into what people who identify on the non-binary side of the gender spectrum. I don't know what they do as they get older. But I think it's interesting that I think with new information, you should be willing to change your views, unless it's, I guess, one of your core fundamental beliefs. Like, you're never going to get me to change my view that murder is wrong. Like, I'm sorry, I've got that as a view. It's not changing. But, you know, again, you say, okay, well, in war, is it still murder? Okay, now we're going into philosophy. And I find it interesting to think about those things, but I think we have to be pragmatic, as well as, you know, set the vision that we want and then use pragmatism to attack the problems that are preventing us from achieving that vision.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Trying to think about what we want to use the, you know, remaining few minutes here to cover. We should start wrapping it up. Jess, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about briefly?
Well, there is something that I'm getting to think that I'm a broken record because I mention it every chance I get when I'm in a public-facing sort of situation like this.
No, go for it.
And it's something that it's a little it takes a lot of scientists aback when they first hear me say it. But that's you know, we're all born scientists, and that is something that is fundamental and inherent to humans that set us apart from most of the animal kingdom. And what I mean when I say that is that when we come out of the womb, I mean, we are testing hypotheses. We are saying, you know, if I cry, does my caretaker come over and interact with me? You know, if I, when kids are starting to crawl around, they say, oh, if I put this in my mouth, does it taste good? You know, that's us as humans in our very nature applying scientific testing to our hypotheses. And by recognizing that that is part of who we are as humans, that's how scientists can figure out how to communicate with the public and how to engage the public and make sure that people aren't terrified of science, which too often they are. They're like, oh, I can't do science. It's too hard. I can't do math. It's too hard. When in reality, if we just encourage people to retain the curiosity that we are all born with and to put that curiosity front and center in how we live our lives and how we encourage children to be, and then how the adults that we want them to grow into, if we prioritize curiosity, then we are going to be fighting the disease of ignorance that is eating away at all of the good works that our society has tried to accomplish. I mean, it's really ignorance that has allowed all of the big horrors of, you know, the millennia to be perpetrated. You tell people that someone is different from them and therefore they're scary or they're not worth treating as a human, then they're willing to enslave people and commit genocide. But with education, you know, with information, and with making sure that people are curious about the world around them and not afraid of it, that is how we actually can reach a more enlightened society. Just encourage that curiosity and say, you know what? Science is yours. I mean, it's your heritage as a human.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah, I think that also, like, I think just bouncing off of that, I think there's something about, it seems like so many people are so eager to fit things into boxes and make sense of things. Like you said, like, we come out of the womb experimenting things immediately. And I think that's because we want to know our surroundings and we want to, you know, categorize things in a way that we can make sense of. And I think it's really sad when people stop asking questions because they think they've categorized things enough. And I think that that is ironically when this ignorance you're talking about sets in. It's when we think we have the answers and we don't have to be curious anymore. And I think that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. It's just so, I don't know. I think when people have a sense of wonder. It opens so many doors, and it's such a beautiful thing. And I mean, I saw it when I was working in mining. I mean, I was really depressed when I went to go work in mining because I'd left my PhD program. I mean, I moved my husband and I and our pets like across an ocean and a continent to go do this, and then it didn't work out. And when I joined, you know, my mining crews out there, and I realized that a lot of these guys I was working with, and it was all guys. I mean, I was on mine sites with 400 people and I was the only woman. But I would work with these guys, and a lot of them had a sixth grade or an eighth grade education at best.
Wow.
And the geologists they worked with on site had never invited them to really look at what the geology work was. These guys were just seen as like basically extensions of the drilling machines. And so when I would say to them, hey guys, look, I found a fossil in this drill core. You want to see a leaf that's a fossil? And they'd come out and they'd be like, whoa. Or like, look, we found some small little, you know, proto shark kind of things, or, you know, they're shark-like creatures in this deposit, and they'd come and see it. Or I'd explain, you know, yeah, iron pyrite, it can spark and cause mine fires. These guys would just light up because it was tapping into a curiosity that they had had at some point, but they had lost over the years. And people just kept treating them like they weren't worth having wonder about the world around them. But in reality, we all are. We all deserve to have a sense of wonder. And it breaks my heart when I see particularly kids living in impoverished circumstances who don't have access to educations, because they'll never get to see how wonderful the world can really be because of the conditions that other humans have made, you know, be their normal.
Wow. That's an incredible story.
Well, you know, it's just, we have to love this life we're given, and it's just hard if barriers are in the way. So I'd like to remove as many of those barriers as possible.
Totally. That's awesome. Well, is there anything you want to plug before we wrap this up? Twitter or social media or anything like that?
Well, I have a podcast I've been doing.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Plug this.
Yeah, it's called Catastrophe. So if people like disasters, apocalyptic type disasters, we talk about the first season. We're just doing human error based ones, but you can look it up. On Facebook, it's Catastrophe Pod. On Twitter, it's Catastrophe Pod as well. And then the website is catastropheshow.com, and it's on all those podcasting networks that are so great. But yeah, if you look up Catastrophe and then Jess Phoenix, you won't confuse it with any other catastrophe shows. Some of them have similar names. But yeah, and it's been a lot of fun, and I've been learning about podcasting, so I appreciate coming on other people's podcasts because now I know how much work it takes.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like, so you're only doing historical ones, I guess, then with human error, but if you do theoretical ones or potential ones in a future season, I'd love to do one on alien attacks.
Yes, that'd be so cool, because I do have people who've been suggesting them. That's actually one of our things on Patreon. If people sign up as patrons, you can suggest future topics, and that's actually a really good one. I had somebody talking about like future warfare as a possibility, but I was like, ooh, so alien attack is actually kind of cool too. I'd love to talk to you about that.
Yeah, or asteroids.
Yes, any of those good space threats.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, to the listeners, we hope you enjoyed this. If you want to follow Andrew and I, you can do that. I'm at Julian Was Here on Twitter. Andrew is at Mars Raider, and we do these episodes every Monday. Thanks again, Jess, for the time.
Thank you, guys. It was fun.
Thanks for listening.